Well, we're pleased to have all of you here this evening to join us to hear Richard Blackett give a talk. We're here, as you know, to commemorate a couple of important bicentennial anniversaries that we're celebrating this year. On January 1st of this year was the 200th anniversary of the closing of the international slave trade by the United States and Great Britain. And it was also the year when Pennsylvania's Gradual Emancipation Act of 1780 came into being. The act stated that any slave born after the date of the passage of that act, which was January 1st, 1780, would become free upon attaining the age of 28. So again, January 1st, 2008 was a very significant year. We're acknowledging these anniversaries with the advent of our new program in African American history funded by the Greenfield Foundation. And we've done a number of events this year to commemorate the occasion. Those of you who were at the reception earlier this evening probably had a chance to see our exhibition, Black Founders, the Free Black Community in the Early Republic, which was curated by our Philip Lapsansky. And if you weren't at the reception, then you perhaps missed the announcement that Phil, after almost 37 years at the library company, effective on June 1st, will be scaling back to halftime, but will maintain his role as curator of African American history. Yeah. Also, we co-sponsored a major conference a couple of weeks ago called Atlantic Emancipations, which drew more than 200 people. This summer, we're presenting a summer seminar for school teachers funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities on abolitionism. And we're also collaborating with the School District of Philadelphia for a teacher training institute this summer, also relating to our holdings of African American history. So in all these ways, we're trying to bring attention to the depth of our collections in this field and the level of our programmatic activity. And this evening, helping us celebrate these occasions and acknowledge these events is Richard Blackett, who holds the Andrew Jackson Chair in American History at Vanderbilt University and is a historian of the abolitionist movement in the United States, and particularly its transatlantic connections and the roles that African Americans played in the movement to abolish slavery. He's the author of a number of books, one of which was called Building an Anti-Slavery Wall, Black Americans in the Atlantic Abolitionist Movement, 1830 to 1860. That was one of his earliest works, which established his name in the field, and he's been quite prolific in the years following. At present, he's working on a study of the ways communities on both sides of the divide, pro and con, organized to support and resist enforcement to the 1850 Fugitive Slave Law, and the ways that slaves, by escaping, influenced the politics of slavery. He's served as associate editor of the Journal of American History, and he's held teaching posts at other universities, and he's been past president of the Association of Caribbean Historians. His title tonight is African Americans, Struggle for Liberty and Equality in the Age of Emancipation. So I'm pleased to introduce Professor Richard Blackett.
Thank you, John. It is a pleasure to be here. I have never given a talk at 8:30 at night after people have been drinking this much. You see what I mean? Usually I'm the one that's drinking and not the audience. When John asked me to give this talk, he said it should be very informal, and I thought I would use PowerPoint and overhead projectors, and then I thought half the audience will be asleep by the second slide. So what I am not going to do that in the interest of forcing you to stay awake. Each table has a designated hitter. Someone who will prod you and nod you and punch you and things like that. It's a daunting topic to be talking at this time of night, but I think it's important that we look at these issues. So I'm going to take two approaches to this discussion. One is biographical, and the other is going to try and look at how people try to attain freedom and liberty in this country, beginning with the antebellum period. If it is true that, as some insist, that biography is the best medium for bringing to light the complex range of people, places, and times involved in historical events, then it seems to me there's no better place to start our exploration of the topic of African American struggle for freedom and liberty in the antebellum period than with a look at the Reverend Henry Highland Garnett. The decision to explore the life and works of Garnett is admittedly arbitrary, but his life, I would argue, points to the range of approaches and options employed by Black Americans in their struggles against slavery and discrimination, a struggle that continued in one form or another long after the abolition of slavery. Like most of his contemporaries in the struggle, Garnett pleaded with America to live up to the principles it so clearly articulated in the Declaration of Independence, and in doing so became the voice of reason, the conscience of a country that promised so much yet never managed to approximate its potential. Garnett was born a slave in Maryland in 1815. His family escaped when he was 9, settled first in Pennsylvania and then in New York City. There, Garnett attended the New York Free African School. Some of the period's most prominent African Americans were educated there. Ira Aldridge, the Shakespearean actor, Alexander Crummell, who later attended Cambridge University, Dr. James McEwen Smith, a graduate in the School of Medicine at Glasgow University, and many others. Garnett and Crummell later attended Canaan Academy in New Hampshire. While there, the school was attacked by a mob opposed to its experiment in interracial education. Garnett later attended Oneida Institute in upstate New York. At the heart of the struggle against the twin oppressions lay a deep and abiding commitment to education. Wherever Garnett went in the years that after he graduated from Oneida, he worked to ensure the expansion of educational opportunities. The Reverend Lewis Woodson of Pittsburgh may have been thinking of Garnett when he insisted that the school, the pulpit, and the press were the natural and legitimate means of the moral elevation of blacks. The first thing Garnett did as a missionary to Jamaica in the mid-1850s was to establish a school for boys and one for girls run by his wife. Garnett accepted a call to be the pastor of the Black Presbyterian Church in Troy, New York, soon after graduation. The church would become Garnett's base of operation for the rest of his life. In the years to come, he would minister to congregations in Geneva, New York, New York City, and Washington, D.C. The church to Garnett was more than just a place of worship. It provided, rather, the institutional foundations, the free space, if you will, on which to build a movement aimed at freeing the slaves and improving the lot of all black Americans. In the years at Troy, he published 2 short-lived newspapers. And even after he relinquished the editor's chair, he maintained an active presence with frequent letters and articles in African American and abolitionist newspapers. Unlike those African-Americans such as William Wells Brown and Charles Lennox Remen, who as members of the Garrisonian wing of the abolitionist movement shun involvement in party politics, Garnett was a prominent member of the Liberty Party, committed to the notion that the quickest means to emancipation lay in the power to influence political decisions in Washington. He predicted in 1842 that the time was not far distant when the Liberty Party will be the most powerful party in our country. Nothing can attest or can arrest its progress. Our principles are sound, founded as they are upon eternal truth and justice. While he admitted that the Nat Turner Rebellion was an attempt by black men to assert their right to humanity and liberty, he saw the party's activities as a way of avoiding such a bloody end to slavery. The time may not yet have arrived for the slaves' deliverance by violent means, but he acknowledged that while the time for a last turn struggle may yet be necessary, he warned and this is a quote, "The finger of the Almighty will hold back the trigger, and his all-powerful arm will sheathe the sword only until the oppressor's cup is full." Yet within months, Garnet would issue his now famous rally to the slaves, rallying cry to the slaves, "Let your motto be resistance, resistance, resistance. No oppressed people have ever secured their liberty without resistance." He followed this bold declaration with a practical cautionary. What kind of resistance you had better make, you must decide by the circumstances that surround you and according to the suggestions of expediency. This was a dramatic departure from the widespread relief that reform was best assured through peaceful means. And as Frederick Douglass and others pointed out, Garnet's own stated commitment to nonviolence. But Garnet did not see the contradiction. The oppressed had above all else to be practical and use whatever means they believed would best assure their liberation. Resistance, as Douglass himself would later admit, was at the heart of the struggle against oppression. But Douglass could not quite explain the apparent contradiction at the heart of Garnet's call for resistance. Imagine then Douglass's surprise when it was announced in 1849 that Garnet had accepted an invitation from British abolitionists to promote the free produce movement. When Douglass wanted to know, did Garnet develop an interest in a movement so committed to nonviolence? How can such a man, Douglass wrote, appeal to the moral sense of England and ask the moral aid of England for the abolition of slavery is the veriest hypocrisy and hollowness. Douglass may well have been protecting the political turf he had cultivated during his very successful tour of Britain a few years earlier. Yet Douglass had a point. How could Garnet square his call on the slaves to resist with the belief in the efficacy of a movement which until that time he had not supported and which wholeheartedly rejected all forms of violence as a means to end in slavery? The problem for Douglass was only heightened when Garnet attended the World Peace Convention in Frankfurt, Germany in 1815 and a London meeting the following year. The hope of the race, he told the London meeting, lay in the adoption of peace principles. But Garnet's thinking was based on a different calculus. He saw an immediate and practical connection between the production of such staples as cotton, on which the major textile industries of Britain had long depended, and the destruction of slavery. Could the staple be cultivated by free labor? Accepting as an article of faith the notion that in the long run, free labor was cheaper and more productive than slave labor, promoters of the free labor cotton cultivation predicted that if it were produced in large enough quantities, it could undermine slave-grown cotton in the South by undermining its competitive edge on world markets. The free produce movement had recorded its greatest success during the height of the struggle to abolish West Indian slavery when it promoted a very effective boycott of sugar grown by slaves. At the height of the agitation over slavery, thousands of British families refused to use sugar grown by slaves, and keep this in mind as you add another lump to your coffee. As Britain's reliance on American cotton continued to grow in the 1840s, it seemed only logical that the old movement could be dusted off and revived in the continuing struggles against American slavery. What had worked before could work again. Garnet's tour of Britain was a rousing success. Wherever he lectured, new organizations were formed and old ones revived. But for proponents of the movement, the problem of how to find alternative sources of cotton seemed daunting. Where could the effort commence? Where were they to find the labor? The flow of cotton grown in the North and West Africa using free labor had begun to arrive in Britain, but it was never more than a trickle. The West Indies, particularly Jamaica, seemed to offer the best hope. The island's sugar industry had collapsed in the wake of emancipation when former slaves abandoned the plantation, seeking instead a future as small producers growing crops other than sugar for the domestic and international markets. The result was just what opponents of West Indian emancipation had predicted. Freed from the supervision of the slave system, freedmen would refuse to work on plantations. Thomas Carlyle recently published a journal, pamphlet called The Occasional Discourse on the Negro Question, a blistering indictment of emancipation and the actions of the freed people, put additional pressure on abolitionists to find ways to get labor to where it was most needed. The free produce movement had the added bonus of providing a means of to both undermine American slavery and adhere to principles of peaceful change. What the movement needed to get it off the ground were a few good men willing to take a leadership role in the experiment. Part of the leadership, promoters anticipated, would come from African Americans. Samuel Ringle Wall, Garnet's cousin, would migrate to Jamaica a few years later with the promise of land on which to experiment with free labor cultivation. James Pennington, who had earlier visited Jamaica, would continue to promote migration to the island throughout the 1850s. Garnet chose a slightly different course, but one which had as one of its objectives the promotion of free labor cultivation. He accepted a commission from the United Presbyterian Church of Scotland to be its missionary in Stirling, Jamaica. This was not Garnet's first missionary commission. He had earlier been involved with the American Home Missionary Society while a minister in Troy, New York. But the Jamaican mission was unlike anything he had done before. There he was to establish schools for the freed people in the area, as well as try to evangelize Africans who had been captured from illegal slave traders and brought to the island as contract laborers. Although Garnet spent only 3 years in Jamaica, his experience there had a lasting influence on his views of the future prospects of African Americans, both at home and abroad. By the end of the decade, these would evolve into a call for the emigration of a select group of skilled black Americans to Africa, where, as he told a meeting in Birmingham, England, in 1861, the white hand of England and the black hand of Africa could develop resources and spread Christianity. The seed of this movement had been planted in his interactions with the roughly 100 liberated Africans, as they were called, who lived near his mission station in Jamaica. Garnet wrote home to his superiors in Scotland that it is here he made contact for the first time with real Africans, people from the Congo, he said, the nation of his forefathers. His hope, he told the Birmingham meeting years later, was that African Americans should go in the spirit of Christian love, with the word of God in their hands and with the plow and other agricultural implements, with the chest of mechanical tools, with men that could use them all well. The effect would be amazing and powerful if the natives could see among them civilized colored men fully imbued with Christianity, who had come to live and die with them. The plan and Garnet's hopes were riddled with all the missionary and even imperial arrogance we have come to associate with the times. But in the wake of experiences in Jamaica, Garnet had come to believe in the efficacy of what a contemporary called the three C's, namely that the children of Africa and Americas were destined to bring Christianity, commerce, and civilization to Africa, the home of their ancestors. In the years after his return to America from Jamaica, Garnet toyed with the idea of immigrating to Liberia. A few years later, he was one of the principal movers in the formation of the African Civilization Society, which aimed to promote the settlement of a select group of African Americans in Abeokuta, Nigeria. On a visit to the area at the end of 1859, Martin Delaney from the United States and Robert Campbell from Jamaica had signed an agreement with the local authorities that allowed for the establishment of a colony of African Americans there. While the society and Delaney clashed over leadership of the effort, Garnet threw himself fully into the drive to garner support for the colony both at home and in Britain, and to encourage black Americans to sign on as colonists. The outbreak of the Civil War in 1861 and opposition from British missionaries in the area around Abeokuta would put paid to the effort. Garnet saw no contradiction between his promotion of emigration to Africa and his firm belief that black Americans should continue the struggle at home. In fact, the success of the African project would be a boost to the struggle for freedom at home. It would show the world that the race was capable of developing what he and others called a nationality, and in so doing add weight to the demands for freedom and justice to those who chose to stay at home. As the war progressed, Garnet did what he could to support the needs and demands of the black troops, and through the African Civilization Society, addressed the needs of the rising number of freedmen who were flooding into Washington from plantations in Maryland and Virginia. It was a time of hope, but Garnet had experienced too much to be euphoric about the future. As he told an overflow crowd that had gathered at the House of Representatives in Washington, D.C. to hear him preach, "When all unjust and heavy burdens shall be removed from every man in the land, when there shall be no more class legislation and no more trouble concerning the black man and his rights, that there is no regard to other American citizens, when in every respect he shall be equal before the law and shall be left to make his own way in the social walks of life, then and only then could it be said that America had loosened the chains of the slaves and recognized all African Americans as citizens." It was too tall an order for America to fill. Within a matter of years, it would become obvious to the most casual observer that yet again, America was unwilling to live up to the promise of freedom and justice for all. In the wake of the retreat from Reconstruction, and Garnet grew increasingly disillusioned. When word came that he was interested in the post of minister resident in Liberia, friends in America prodded him to withdraw his name, insisting that he was needed at home. Garnet wrote his old schoolmate Crummell, who had only just returned to the U.S. after almost two decades in Liberia. He said, "What would you have me linger here in an old age of neglect and want? Would you have me tarry among men who have forgotten what I have done and what I have suffered for them? To stay here and die among those ungrateful people? No, I go gladly to Africa. Please the Lord, I can only safely cross the ocean, land on the coast of Africa, look around upon the green fields, tread the soil of my ancestors, live it but a few weeks. Then I shall be glad to lie down and be buried beneath the sod." Garnet had his wish. He sailed for Liberia in November 1882, where he died not long after his arrival. It is a particularly poignant end to a life filled with struggle against immense odds. Garnet had major differences with many of his contemporaries over the best course of action to pursue. He was reviled in some quarters for his support of immigration to Africa and his leadership of the African Civilization Society, which in spite of its best efforts was seen by opponents as promoting the removal of free blacks from the United States. But in spite of these differences, a profile of Garnet's civil and political activities stands as representative of the range of approaches contemporaries took in the struggle to eliminate slavery and discrimination. He was a member of an abolitionist society, the American and Foreign Anti-Slavery Society, a feature in the Liberty Party, a leading voice in the Negro Convention movement, a proponent of the free produce, peace, and temperance movements, and an advocate for the emigration of a select skilled group of African Americans to Africa. Not many others, with the possible exception of Crummell and Theodore Holly, were missionaries, but far more relied on the institutional foundations of the black church in small towns and large cities to launch their attack on the twin evils of slavery and discrimination. This is when I ask my student who does that to leave the room. And I usually put them out too. Most probably I shouldn't do that. Most probably that's a stakeholder, you know. In the end, the struggle took a fearful personal toll on Garnet, as it did so many of his contemporaries. He may have grown his disillusion with black America for its constant carping and irritating criticism of his activities. His people were never able to provide him with a reasonable living as a minister. The pleading and begging he fought for greater support from his churches at times were worn Garnet's pride and his sense of fairness. And always there was the almost debilitating certainty of American slavery and discrimination. Many of his contemporaries also succumbed to the pressures that were a consequence of the attacks on the slave system. Pennington, a prominent temperance advocate, turned to the bottle late in life. J. Sella Martin hid pain from a lung ailment in laudanum, to which he became addicted. But while Garnet's life provides a window through which we can glimpse the range of activities of those considered leaders in the struggle for African-American rights in the 19th century, we should not overlook the fact that in countless other ways, others whose names history has overlooked have also fought to right the wrongs they face in their daily lives. Here, too, Garnet's activities provide a useful starting point. Wherever he lived, Garnet was active in the effort to aid and promote those fleeing slavery. From his earliest days as a minister in Troy, he was a pivotal player in what we have come to call the Underground Railroad. As in so much else he did, Garnet took a pragmatic approach to aiding fugitive slaves. When they needed to be hidden and fed, they found sanctuary in his churches. When they needed the protection of the community from slave catchers, he rallied the community. And when it was thought the best way to ensure the fugitive slavery was to purchase the slave, Garnet raised the money to do so. In the months before he sailed for England, Garnet had begun raising funds to purchase the Weems family. The father, John, already free and living in Rockville, Maryland, was anxious to get his wife and children out of slavery. One of the daughters, Stella, had escaped earlier and was living with the Garnets in Geneva, New York. She accompanied them first to England and then to Jamaica, where she died not long after the family settled in Sterling. Garnet continued to solicit funds to buy the family while he was in England. As we know, slaves took the initiative to escape, sometimes on their own, or like Stella Weems, with family members, or even in groups made up of non-family members from adjoining plantations. Up and down the line between slavery and freedom, from Maryland and Virginia in the east to Missouri in the west, and in the south along the Rio Grande River, slaves kept a constant pressure on the system by taking their leave. The system did what it could to stem the bleeding, establishing associations of slaveholders which employed posses to prevent escape or recapture slaves, and flexed their political muscle to ensure that local, state, and federal governments did what they could to support the effort. Yet slaves continued to escape in increasing numbers, motivated by a desire to find freedom. They knew what freedom was, and in escaping, they proved their commitment to freedom. John Anderson, a Baltimore slave, spoke for most when he was brought before a magistrate in Savannah, Lamar, Jamaica. The magistrate wanted to know whether Anderson was a slave, and if he was, why he had escaped on a ship to Jamaica. Anderson said, I have been kept in bondage And hearing that this was a free country, I tried to get here. Whether it was James Pembroke who walked from Frederick, Maryland to Pennsylvania, or William and Ellen Craft who devised an ingenious scheme to escape from Macon, Georgia around Christmas 1848, or John Hall and James Burris, the two slaves of Montgomery Bell, probably the South's premier ironmaster, who left Nashville with a large amount of Bell's money, meant for the recently freed slaves who had gone to Liberia, or those like Alex, a Nashville slave who paid an unnamed white man $60 and a silver watch to crate him in a box and send him to Cincinnati, or those who stored away on boats plying the waters of the Chesapeake Bay, or the nameless groups who stampeded to freedom across the Ohio River, they all had one thing in mind: freedom from slavery and a better life in free territory. Each escape was a profound political act of dispossession, a point not missed by slaveholders and their supporters. Not only did they take their lives in their own hands, on many occasions they made sure to demonstrate their sense of entitlement by helping themselves to their master's property. Taking a horse or mule was obviously meant to get them to their destination faster. But as slave advertisements attest, many left with suits of clothes as much as they could wear and carry. In May 1856, 8 slaves escaped from the area in Montgomery County, Maryland, taking with them $300 worth of silks, dresses, and jewelry. When the escapees settled in black rural communities just across the line into freedom, they put some distance between themselves and slavery, but never far enough to lose contact with family and friends left behind, and in so doing set a standard to which those still in slavery could aspire. Some made sorties back across the line to bring out family members and friends, and when they did not do so personally, they paid others to get family members out. From the security of their new homes, they wrote friends and family, suggesting ways they could get out. When the Reverend Jacob Green's son sent his father, a free black living on the eastern shore of Maryland, trade schedules, an escape map containing possible escape routes, which he should have passed on to slaves planning to leave. In September 1851, the black settlement of Christiana, Pennsylvania, came to defense of one of its members who was being pursued by his former owner. By the time the shooting was over, one of the slave catchers from Maryland lay dead. But the Christiana shootout also points to the fact that masters knew where to look for their former slaves, which added to the sense of vulnerability of the settlements on free soil. When slave catchers from St. Louis or the area to the south of the city, when slaves escaped from St. Louis or the area to the south of the city, slaveholders went directly to black settlements outside Alton, Illinois, confident that slaves would go there even if they did not plan to make it their final destination. Those who settled in larger cities could rely on the security and anonymity created by numbers. Following passage of the 1850 Fugitive Slave Law, more than 200 blacks fled Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, in a matter of weeks in search of greater security further north. Not all of those were former slaves, but some undoubtedly were, and were now anxious to move their families away to the security of Canada. But the cities also provided an additional measure of protection, as the Crafts found out when in October 1850, the Boston black community came out in force to prevent slave catchers from taking them. Others, such as Anthony Burns, were not so fortunate. But the return of Burns should not lead us to dismiss the level of protection provided by black urban communities. But these activities take us beyond the scope of this talk tonight. They do point to the fact, however, that the struggle for freedom took many forms. What Garnet did to promote the cause as a member of the Liberty Party was matched by those slaves who, calculating the odds, decided to take leave of slavery. In many ways, Garnet's support of the fugitive was made manifestly easier because slaves took the initiative. His effort to raise the asking price for the Weems family started when Stella turned up on his doorstep in Geneva, New York. The same is true of abolitionists and black communities' defenses of the crafts. Behind these activities lay a conviction that in spite of the countless laws passed on the federal and state levels, in spite of court rulings which went against them, in spite of police systems developed to keep them in slavery, this was equally their country, one that had the potential to reform itself and in so doing live up to its potential as truly a land of liberty. Equally, there were times when entrenched interests, some thought an incomprehensible perversity, seemed bent on defying this potential. It is at times like these that many came close to accepting the Jeffersonian notion that there was no future for blacks in a white America, and as a consequence, they looked to a future elsewhere. In the broad sweep of American history, periods of promise, such as the years after the Revolutionary War and the Civil War, are followed by times that not only try men's souls, but also a commitment to a future in the United States. Let me suggest a rather bleak note on which to end this talk. Are we again in the midst of trying times following the promises of the Civil Rights Movement? Thank you.